It's Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN. Presented by the Windjammer Restaurant and Upper Deck Pub. Local, fresh, and Burlington's original steak and seafood restaurant. Now, here's your host, Brady Farkas.
What's up, everybody? Brady Farkas, Champlain Valley. Game night right here on a Wednesday on 101.3 ESPN, 101.3ESPN.com, and we are always streaming on the 101.3 ESPN app. Appreciate you being with us. We go up until 7 o'clock, and then we have no live sports on 101.3 ESPN today, but Celtics basketball over on 960. They are taking on the Dallas Mavericks, and again, they will do so without Marcus Morris as well. John in Colchester says the clip was Matthias Kiwanuka, who used to play for the Giants, the cheap shot at Boston College in 2005. I'll have to check it out in the break. What's coming up on the show today? Stefania Bell is just minutes away. We'll talk about UVM's loss to Marquette last night, 91-81. I'll give you my take on some of what Aaron Boone had to say. We've got some sad news regarding New England Patriots history, and I'll react to something that Amani Toomer just told us at 6:40. But first, I do want to say this. A lot of you guys, if you've been on social media at all today, you've seen the photos and the video footage out of Southern California and the wildfires that are going on there. You've seen them on Facebook. You've seen them on Twitter. There's a lot of pictures of people driving to and away from traffic that's just unbelievable when you talk about the photographic evidence of these fires. It's devastating, and I want to share this story. I generally don't ever tell the story of who didn't make it on the show, like who we reached out to and who couldn't do it, who we couldn't coordinate a time with. I never tell those stories, but I'm going to tell this one. Jessica Mendoza is one of the broadcasters for ESPN Sunday Night Baseball, and Jessica Mendoza was going to come on today in Champlain Valley Game Night, and she was going to talk about Aaron Boone, the hiring of Aaron Boone, who used to work at ESPN. Right on the day of Boone's press conference, we had this interview set up for 3 or 4 days now, and Jessica Mendoza was really, really excited to come on with us, and she was super pumped up about it, and we were pumped up to have her. And she texted me today and said, "Brady, I'm really sorry. I just can't do it. The fires are out of control. They are crazy. My kids were, had their school canceled today. We're trying to help family, trying to help other friends get to safety and get out of here." And I told her, of course, look, we'd love to have you on sometime, but you take care of the real life personal stuff first. And I just wanted you guys to know that story because it's bad. And a lot of you guys have seen the footage. My whole family lives in Southern California, so I'm thinking of them as well. They don't live, in the immediate area around Los Angeles and Bel Air where these fires are. So by all accounts, everyone in my family is safe, but a lot of people aren't there. And Jessica Mendoza was going to come on today, but it was unable to. So we will try to make that happen. But we wish her and the friends she's trying to help the absolute best as well. So it's Champlain Valley Game Night again here on 101.3 ESPN. Now let's go out to the TikTok Jewelers guest line and find ourselves, as we do every Wednesday at this time, lucky enough to have her every week from ESPN. It's our ESPN NFL insider, fantasy football expert, and injury expert wrapped up all in one. We met her in Bristol for the first time a couple of weeks ago. It's Stefania Bell. Stefania, thanks for being with us again this week. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
We're good as well. And interesting week here in Patriots country. Rob Gronkowski gets the suspension on Monday for his late hit on Bills defensive back Tre'Davious White. First and foremost, what did you think of the hit when you saw it?
Didn't like it. I mean, it was pretty obvious. There was enough of a delay that it was clear that Gronk thought about it and then came back and jumped on him. And, it was just that picture of a player who's face down, who doesn't know it's coming. Gronk is not small. There was a lot of between his body weight and the fact that he got airborne, that his arm comes down, he wears a brace on that one arm. I mean, there was just a lot of things. And I actually wondered, what is he doing? Why is he doing this, especially in this day and age when we're talking about safety more and more? Yeah. It just seems so out of character, too. I mean, this is a guy who's, we enjoy him in the league. He's he's done things right when it comes to how he behaves on the field. I mean, the thing we all laugh about is him spiking the ball. So it just really stood out to me as an isolated incident, but one that definitely needed to be addressed.
Tre'Davious White enters the concussion protocol, and in this era of worrying about head trauma and head injuries, this was a tough week for the NFL. We saw Tre'Davious White in that play, Ryan Shazier on Monday Night Football. I mean, the NFL continues to have to worry about this stuff.
And I think they will going forward. And I think, you know, there's been conversation now this week, perhaps more than at any point so far this season, about the importance of players policing themselves. I don't know if that's the language I would use, but players need to be a part of the process. And you can make all the rules you want, but if the players show complete disregard for those rules at times, as you can see, it only takes one hit, one episode for things to escalate to a point where they're regrettable. And for me, it's been a tough week of watching because I've seen things I think, well, they know better than this. I mean, you could even go back to where Russell Wilson and the whole issue where he was basically motioned to the sideline by the official and basically went in and ducked out of the medical tent before he could be evaluated, regardless of whether he thought he was fine or not. And I know the league is investigating this, and I don't have all the information, but certainly there was enough on video to show you that nobody evaluated him. And as a player, you have to speak up. Now, we are seeing players do more to report symptoms after the fact. You know, they are coming forward if they believe they have suffered a concussion, and that's really important because self-reporting is key to helping manage the condition. But they have to be mindful in terms of not look. You can't protect against all hits. They're going to happen in football, and I think people understand that. But when you see deliberate actions of violence, for lack of a better word, from one player against another, especially when one player is in a defenseless position, I think the league has to respond.
Stefani, I want to go back to Gronk for a second. I want to provide some context on this. So Tre'Davious White goes into the concussion protocol. Going back a few years in baseball, remember the Chase Utley slide where he slid into Ruben Tejada and we had the Chase Utley slide rule now? So I was in the minority. At the time, I didn't think that that slide was dirty. But Tejada broke his leg, so I felt that because Tejada broke his leg, that's why Utley was suspended. The league felt like they had to suspend Utley because Tejada got hurt. Do you think if White doesn't get a concussion, Gronk isn't suspended? Do you think the fact that he did get hurt meant the league had to suspend Gronk?
It's an interesting question. I certainly can't say what was in their minds, but I will say this. We looked at players who were suspended prior to the Gronk incident for fighting. And part of the issue around those fights was concerns about player safety because it all rolls together. If we're going to be talking about player safety and suspending people for helmet-to-helmet contact, then if they're swiping at each other's heads, we definitely have to take them out. I think the fact that it was a deliberate act, I think if they had just collided and that had happened, we wouldn't be having the same conversation. I mean, there might have been a fine for a helmet-to-helmet because we know that many of those that get fined, they're not intentional, but they're trying to change the player's technique or tactics, if you will. But in this case, it was the intent. And I know it's hard to say to speak about intent because you can't get in the mind of what was going on with the player. But we can say this. It was after the play.
Yeah.
It was not part of the play. So whatever the intent was, which we don't presume to fully know, it was after the play. And that gave them the door to deliver a punishment. And had they not, it certainly would have not been good optics, I don't believe, for a league that is talking so much about player safety. So I think it had to be done regardless of whether White suffered an injury or not. And it's unfortunate that he did, but I think it only serve to put an exclamation point on the situation.
Stefani Bell of ESPN with us here on Champlain Valley Game Night, as she is every Wednesday at this time on 101.3 ESPN. I want to know something medically. We've talked a lot about the Giants and how injuries have derailed their season, and we focused a lot on Brandon Marshall and Odell Beckham Jr., but another one of their young receivers, Sterling Shepard, he's missed a couple of games this year, and the reason why is migraine headaches. What exactly goes on in a migraine? I don't even know how people become, You know, like I remember Percy Harvin getting migraines a lot. I don't know why guys are more prone to them and what exactly happens.
Well, it's certainly something you could spend a whole, you know, you could spend an hour talking about this topic, and it's actually gotten me to thinking that one of my Answering the Bell podcasts, where I take these medical topics and do a deeper dive, I think we might be heading to one on migraines, because it's certainly not my particular area of expertise, and there are people who specialize in this area. That's how vast it is. And I can tell you this from being a physical therapist, sometimes there is a cervical and neck component to headaches. Migraines are often largely thought to be vascular issues. And so I think the people who study this and who know the most about it will tell you that one of the most important things is identifying the triggers, the source, sort of the pattern of the headaches, and then working from there. And if you listen to Sterling Shepard speak about it, he said that he's had migraines since he was a kid, but they had been far less common since childhood. So I think sometimes you think, well, this is basically behind me. And then something happened for him to develop migraines again. And I think now that that's been the case, he's got to get back with the medical folks and figure out, okay, how do we manage this going forward? And apparently just this week, Alex Collins from the Ravens, yeah, now also dealing with migraines. So it's a very real issue. I would caution anyone who thinks, oh, it's a headache. You could just, no, this is a very real issue, and they have to be managed individually. And I think that's really the challenge. It's not like there's an automatic, easy answer when you're dealing in season and you're looking at a calendar or a schedule. That doesn't always fit with how complex the injury is.
So finally, let's move to an injury that has some positive momentum behind it right now, and that's Aaron Rodgers, the Packers quarterback. He's practicing again, and it looks like he's all set to come back this season. The team's 6-6 right now. Is Aaron going to be 100% when he comes back?
Yeah, they keep winning, and it just keeps making it more and more likely that he does. Like, they certainly wouldn't push him back if he weren't ready, but you're right. If there was zero reason to come back, you wonder if it would even be in the conversation. We have to remember, the rehab doesn't stop either just because the team has a particular record. So it's him moving through the steps of rehabilitation would be happening. But the fact that they're actually bringing him back into practice, he did practice on Saturday, and now he's doing sort of this combo of rehab work and practice, I think that signaled to us that they are planning on bringing him back, assuming everything goes well. Obviously, there are progressions to be made. He's got to get his full strength and endurance back. They need to be confident from any imaging studies they do that he is healed to the point where they feel good about him returning. There are no guarantees. I mean, if he does return in week 15 and he takes the right kind of hit, even if the fracture has healed, the bone internally is still remodeling for several months. And there's a risk of if you strike it right around the hardware that might be a more vulnerable area. So to say that he could come back and they could be guaranteed he wouldn't refracture, that's not possible. But they can feel pretty secure in the notion that he is unlikely to refracture, yeah, if he shows good healing. So I do think you're going to see him back. Everything's pointing to it, as you say.
Stefania Bell, ESPN, with us, also our fantasy football expert, so I want to head towards fantasy football. A lot of leagues headed to the playoffs this week or just 1 week away from the playoffs. So let's talk about some of our playoff questions. One, Matt Ryan's the MVP of the league, but he put up a dud in terms of statistical productivity this weekend. Is Matt Ryan, the reigning MVP of the league, a quarterback we should consider not playing in the fantasy playoffs?
It's sad, right?
Yeah.
It's possible that you would think that. You know, it's interesting because he actually has a few good weeks coming up, and he's shown some signs of life lately. I mean, last week was not good, but the Vikings are playing out of their mind, and who would have thought that that situation would be what it was? But if you look at the 3 weeks before that, his completion percentages were up over 70%. He was throwing for more yardage, 317 yards in week 12, as compared to the 173 you saw last week. So I do think New Orleans has been a little thin in their secondary. That's who they face next. I think you're going to see a lot of passing there. But it always depends on your options, you know. And yeah. if you have somebody who you know is going to deliver you more yards, who's going to be airing the ball out, then maybe that's a better option for you. You know, right now it's hard because we've seen so many ups and downs with the quarterbacks across the league that there's not even anyone who's putting up consistently great numbers. If you had a quarterback like Russell Wilson, I doubt you have a Russell Wilson and a Matt Ryan. But if you were to be lucky enough to have that, I'm looking for a quarterback who can use his legs, who might deliver you more fantasy points in that regard. Tyrod Taylor is a quarterback you would have potentially considered because he is a dual threat, but he's banged up now too. So you're not going to get the rushing yardage out of him. I don't know that it really would depend on my options, and I don't know that I'm running away from Matt Ryan, but you are nervous about which Matt Ryan you're going to see because he hasn't been the MVP this year for sure.
You talk about the Falcons. They're taking on the Saints on Thursday Night Football, and, well, the Saints have arguably the most valuable fantasy player in the world right now in Alvin Kamara. Just how good has this rookie been?
I mean, I don't know that there are enough superlatives to talk about how good he's been. I mean, and, you know, him being so good has helped Mark Ingram. I mean, really, once they moved Adrian Peterson, who turned out to not be a great fit for them at all of a sudden, they looked really good with this 1-2 punch of Ingram and Kamara, and both of them are used in the passing game. Kamara is definitely, like, the lighted up explosive player, and I think he's just so fun to watch. Beyond, you know, if you're picking one, he's probably your number one at this point. I mean, we were talking on our podcast about the potential for coming into next season looking at Kamara as one of your top five overall picks in fantasy for next year. He's been that good.
Unbelievable. Stefania Bell, our ESPN fantasy football expert, our NFL insider, and our injury expert, wrapped up all in one. Lucky to have her on every Wednesday at this time. Stefania, enjoy week 14. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right. Have a great week.
There she goes, Stefania Bell. Stefania, always nice enough to join us 6:05 on Wednesdays, and lucky to have her. Yeah, the idea that Matt Ryan, the MVP of the NFL, might be somebody you would think about not starting round one of your fantasy football playoffs is just mind-blowing, but it continues to show you just how unpredictable the league is, and for a lot of reasons, that's why we love it. All right, when we come back, a couple takeaways from the Aaron Boone press conference. Also, what is Bill Belichick's obligation as a head coach of the New England Patriots? And also, some sad news on a former Pats head coach. That's all next on 101.3 ESPN.
Tomorrow, it's Champlain Valley Game Night with Brady Farkas, only on 101.3 ESPN.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Champlain Valley Game Night here on a Wednesday on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. Also, remember, on the 101.3 ESPN app, if you want to get in on the Town Fair Tire text line, you can do so now at 802-655-6672. Aaron Boone introed as the 33rd manager of the New York Yankees today, and I found the press conference to be revealing in a couple different ways. One, I was unimpressed with the press conference's production value, and Buster Olney told us in the huddle that, you know, what are you really expecting from a managerial press conference? And you're right, not a lot of bells and whistles, but I'm expecting the microphone to be at the proper height for Aaron Boone, and it wasn't. I'm expecting Hal Steinbrenner, one of the owners of the team, to smile for the photo, to help him put the jersey on for the photo, and none of that happened. I was surprised about that stuff. As far as what Boone said, I liked a lot of it. A couple of things I had problems with. I'll play some of that sound back and react to it. Number one, I disagree with Buster Olney on something. Aaron Boone, in my mind, does not want to really talk about the home run that he hit in 2003, Game 7, ALCS off the Boston Red Sox. Aaron Boone talked about that.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, people know me for that. People have treated me very well when I come back here because of that. Maybe it certainly allows for some good graces to start things off, but, you know, ultimately now I'm going to be judged on my performance. And to me, that performance is, again, impacting players and helping guys take another step.
That was Aaron Boone talking about the swing, the home run in 2003. Buster Olney says Boone doesn't like talking about it because he's humble, and Buster Olney would know Aaron Boone far greater than I would. They've worked together at ESPN for the last 8 years, and Buster Olney undoubtedly covered Aaron Boone throughout his 12-year Major League career. He knows what makes Aaron Boone tick better than Brady Farkas does. I read it, though, as I think Aaron Boone has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder, and I don't know that that's a bad thing, but Boone doesn't want to be known as a one-hit wonder in my mind. Can anybody name outside of the Yankees any of the teams that Aaron Boone played for? Do you remember that he played for the Cincinnati Reds and was an all-star? Do you remember that he played for the Florida Marlins? Do you remember he played for the Houston Astros? Do you remember that he played for the Cleveland Indians? And there's another one in there, too, that I don't even remember off the top of my head. But in my mind, I think Aaron Boone probably is a guy with a chip on his shoulder. He doesn't want to be remembered for one play. And he doesn't want to probably have to live in the shadow of his family name anymore. I mean, every time you hear about Aaron Boone, what do you hear? He's from a baseball family. Hey, did you know that his dad, his grandpa, and his brother all played in the majors? Did you know that Brett Boone is his brother and Brett Boone hit 37 homers and 141 RBIs in 2001? Did you know that his dad played in the majors? And did you know his grandpa did too? I mean, those are things that I feel like Aaron Boone has probably heard his whole life. And now his whole post-career, he's heard about that one play. I think Aaron Boone is eager to move on from his family name, or eager to move out of the shadow of his family name, but also eager to move out of the shadow of that one play. In the same way that a lot of one-hit wonder bands, a lot of them grow tired of that one hit and don't even want to play it again. I don't think Boone is going to enjoy talking about 2003 a whole lot. Also, things that I took away. Boone talked about the relationship between analytics and between the human element of managing.
A balance is a great way of putting it, because there's certainly a balance. I've been a guy that's really tended to buy in to all the analytics that are going on. This is an organization that leans on and relies on analytics, so I frankly can't wait to dive in and ingest all the information that we have, and I look forward to starting a few days ago, starting now, starting in spring training, taking all the information we get and then being able to get it in the hands of our players. And I think where the balance comes in is being able to tap into each individual in that room. Who can we overwhelm with information? Who wants a ton of information? Who do we need to leave alone? I think that's the art form in that room.
I think that's really interesting. I think it's really interesting to hear Boone say that the art form is figuring out who wants it and who doesn't want it. And that amazes me. It was always amazing to me when guys didn't want all of that information. What I mean is this. If I could steal the signs, I wanted it. Like, if somebody had the signs, I want to know. Yeah, it's going to be a fastball. Okay, I want to know that. It's going to be a curveball. Okay, I want to know that. And when I could steal the signs, I wanted to tell everybody. I wanted to give them a code. You know, here's how it would go. I'd be coaching first base. If I could get the signs, hey, first name. If I say your first name, hey, come on, Brady, it's a fastball. If I say your last name, hey, what do you say, Farkas? It's a curveball. That's how it worked, and that's how simple it was. Some guys didn't want to know that. They're like, hey, I just want to see ball, hit ball, man. I'm like, I have no idea how on earth you do not want to know what pitch is coming. They're like, man, I just don't. I just want to see it and hit it. Because I was not that way. I was paralysis by analysis. I was absolutely interested in knowing everything. When I coached, we had hit charts. We had tendency charts. We had spray charts. We had pitch charts. We had everything. We were charting everything. I wanted batters to see that, hey, man, on 0-0, he's throwing a fastball to every batter of this game. And so by the sixth inning, you need to know that he throws first pitch fastballs, and you need to be expecting that. Some guys hated that. Some guys went over and looked at that chart religiously. Some guys never went to that chart. It always irritated me, the guys who didn't. Aaron Boone says, there are some guys that don't want that stuff, and that's okay. We'll know it, but we don't have to inundate them with everything. I thought that was interesting, and I liked that a lot. The one thing that I did not like that Aaron Boone had to say, the one thing that really, really rubbed me the wrong way, is when Aaron Boone was asked about how important is it for him as a manager with no managerial experience and no major league coaching experience, how important is it for him to have a coaching staff where there's a ton of experience?
Well, we already have Larry Rothschild, so that's all kinds of experience. Experience is certainly a factor and something that should be of value. But it's not the end all for me and not a prerequisite. I want smart sitting next to me. I want confident sitting next to me. I want a guy that can walk out in that room and, as I've talked to you guys about relationships that I expect to have with my players, I expect that to be even more so with my coaching staff. So I want smart guys capable of connecting and impacting players. And whether that's a guy with all kinds of experience or little experience, I'm not real concerned about that.
I did not like what Boone had to say there. I think it's important when you don't have that experience to surround yourself with people that do. I love what the Red Sox have done with Alex Cora's staff. And Cora put his staff together, but I love what they've done. They've got Tony La Russa in the front office. They've got an analytics department in the front office. Those guys are supplements to Alex Cora. We've got the research side and the experience side, and La Russa's won world championships before and has been doing this forever. I love that. On the field, he's got Ron Renicki, who is a former big league manager who's been in the game for 27 years or something like that, and 20 of them are as a professional coach. I love that. I like the staff around Alex Cora. I'm not in love with the idea of Boone saying, hey, man, we can all come into this thing green. I don't think that's the way that it works. Now, Larry Rothschild as your pitching coach is a huge benefit, but I think you need some other guys as your bench coaches that have been there and have done that before. There's a reason why, you know, young guys growing up, they want to talk to their dad about things. Hey, Dad, what was it like when you were growing up? Well, because your dad has had those experiences before, and he knows how to handle them. Or if he made a mistake, he knows how to tell you what not to do. Aaron Boone needs that kind of mentorship on his coaching staff, and I was a little alarmed to hear him say that that's not really something that mattered. It's Champlain Valley Game Night here on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. You know, we got thinking about this yesterday. And again, if you want to get in, 802-655-6672. We got thinking about this yesterday. Josh McDaniels is the Patriots offensive coordinator. He may or may not want to be a head coach. He's going to be rumored for head coaching jobs as he is every single year. And there's going to be, man, there could be 5-6 jobs open. I mean, you could see Vance Joseph in Denver. You could see Hugh Jackson in Cleveland. You could see Bruce Arians in Arizona. I think that's possible that he would get fired. You could see Marvin Lewis in Cincinnati, possibly. I mean, that's 4. You've already got the Giants opening. That's 5. Todd Bowles in New York, I think he's done enough to stave off his job. That could be 6. If things got crazy, Andy Reid could be 7 in Kansas City. I would hope not, but it's possible. Dirk Cutter in Tampa, that would be 8. There could be 8 coaches potentially fired. Again, I hope it doesn't go that way for some of those guys, but Josh McDaniels is going to be a candidate. Now, he may not want to be a head coach anymore. Maybe he's decided that it's okay to just be, you know, quote, just be a coordinator for the New England Patriots, and that would be his prerogative. But I started thinking, what's the obligation of Bill Belichick to McDaniels and Matt Patricia? Because in college, I think the head coach's job is to develop his assistants so that they can go be head coaches. I really think it is about, yeah, you want to win national championships, but you also want to help your players prepare for life after college, whether that be in the NFL or in the professional world. And I think you have an obligation to help prepare your coaches. And I don't know that that's the same in the NFL. In fact, I don't think it's the same in the NFL. Now, Bill Belichick, I believe, has developed his coaching staff to the point where McDaniels and Patricia both potentially could be head coaches. But I don't think that it's McDaniels or Belichick's responsibility to encourage McDaniels to leave to go chase a head coaching job. I remember when I was coaching junior college baseball at Hudson Valley Community College, the head coach and the manager of the program to me said, Brady, hey, I'm going to work with you, and we're going to get you a job. And if a job came up, he talked to me about it. He said, hey, man, what do you think about this one? What do you think about that one? I don't think you're ready for that one. I think you could get that one. You know, you're a year or two away. Here's what I want to see if you want to get to that level. And he helped me constantly try to develop me and get me to the point where I could have been a head coach at the Division III level or an assistant at the Division I level. And did I want to work at this camp or that camp? He was great with that stuff. And frankly, if some other things hadn't happened, mainly him leaving to take a different job, I probably would be a college baseball coach right now and not a sports radio person. And I'm so happy with the way things worked out, but I was headed on that path. And he spent a lot of time trying to develop me as a coaching personality and as someone that could go and get a better, you know, a quote, better job in a bigger place and have a head job. We talked about it constantly. I don't think that that's Bill Belichick's obligation to Josh McDaniels. If McDaniels wants to leave, then I certainly think that Belichick doesn't have a right to try to hold him back. But I also don't think he needs to be encouraging him and saying, hey, man, this job would be great for you. That job, this job would be – because Belichick needs to win. And ultimately, I think it's Belichick's job to make sure that the New England Patriots win. And if the best way that the New England Patriots win is to have things be as they are now with Patricia, the defensive coordinator, and McDaniels, the offensive coordinator, and Belichick, the head coach, I don't think Belichick needs to go out of his way to try to push McDaniels, you know, try to encourage McDaniels into being a head coach. And I don't think it makes Belichick a bad guy if he desires McDaniels and Patricia to stay. Again, if they approach you and say, Bill, I'm thinking of leaving, what do you think about it? I don't think he should hold back. But I also don't think it's his primary responsibility. I don't think he owes it to them to try to land them head coaching jobs. I do believe that is the job of a college coach. I do not believe that that is the job of a head coach at the professional level. Just how I feel. If you think differently or the same, 802-655-6672. A sad note, and a lot of you Patriot fans that have been Patriot fans for a long time will remember this. Death today of Ron Meyer. Ron Meyer died today. He's a former head coach of the New England Patriots. And as Rich said when we talked about this pre-show in the huddle, yeah, a lot of our listeners don't even remember there was life before Bill Belichick. And there was. And Bill Parcells and Pete Carroll. You know, so the 90s really were a high-profile time for the Patriots. And Pete Carroll at the time wasn't high-profile, but Bill Parcells still was at that point. And then you move on to Belichick. But in the 80s, the Patriots were really, really bad. And Ron Meyer took the team over, and I want to say it was 82. I think he was there 82 to 84. He was part of a strike-shortened season. The team's coming off 2-14 years. He got them to 5-4 and got them to the playoffs in a strike-shortened year. Ends up his tenure as 18-15, which at the time, to leave the Patriots with a winning record, was a big deal. And Ron Meyer has a legacy with the Patriots that maybe not everyone equates to him. If you're thinking about the old Patriots, arguably the most iconic game still in Patriots history, maybe more so than 28-3, maybe more so than Malcolm Butler, is the snowplow game. Ron Meyer was the head coach that called the timeout in the snowplow game in the 84 playoffs where the Patriots beat the Dolphins, Raiders, Dolphins, I think, 3-0. And Meyer's the guy who calls the timeout so they could go out and clear off the patch for the kicker to kick. And also, think about the modern-day Patriots. A lot of the success for the Patriots has been that some of that coaching continuity, whether it be for a decade or just year, you know, some year-to-year stuff. Dante Scarnecchia is still the offensive line coach of the Patriots. He's been the offensive line coach for the Patriots for a while. Ron Meyer hired him on staff. Dante Scarnecchia was brought to New England to be on Ron Meyer's staff back in those early years of the 80s. And he's been with Belichick, and he's been with Belichick for a long time, and he left for a little bit, and the offensive line got worse, and Belichick said, we need you back, and here you go. The team's won 2 Super Bowls in 3 years. Dante Scarnecchia brought in by Ron Meyer. Ron Meyer dead today, I want to say at the age of 76. So he was brought in 1982. He had been the previous head coach at SMU. Robert Kraft said, I am sad to hear of Ron Meyer's passing. He was a colorful head coach who was very entertaining for fans during his tenure. One of the greatest things Ron did when hired in 1982 was to bring us a young coach from his staff at SMU named Dante Scarnecchia. 35 years later, that hire has proven to be a lasting legacy. On behalf of the entire Patriots organization, we send our thoughts and prayers to the Meyer family and the many friends who are mourning his loss. So Ron Meyer dead today at the age of 76. When we come back, Amani Toomer said something very interesting an hour ago. I've got to react to that. And then we'll get a little bit into how do you like your rivalries. We'll talk about that. It's all next on Champlain Valley.
It's Champlain Valley Game Night with Brady Farkas. Only on 101.3 ESPN.
All right, everybody, last segment here, Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. An hour ago in the huddle, Amani Toomer, former New York Giants wide receiver, a guy who was one of my favorite Giants growing up, a guy who, when I used to go to Giants training camp at the University at Albany, was always one of the guys I was seeking out. I like Amani Toomer. I asked him an hour ago if he thought that the Juju Smith-Schuster block on Vontaze Burfict was dirty, and he said no, and he said part of the reason why basically is karma. Vontaze Burfict needs to realize that that's what he does to people. So in my mind I was thinking, well, Amani, you said it's not dirty, but then you called it karma for all the dirty things that Burfict does, so you ultimately do think it's dirty, but you think that Burfict deserves it. And I don't live by that logic. I love Amani Toomer, but I disagree with him here pretty vehemently. Just because Vontaze Burfict has been a dirty player, it doesn't give you the right to go and be a dirty player back. That just makes you a dirty player. Like, that doesn't make the play not dirty. Juju Smith-Schuster had a blindside block, which is illegal. He led with his helmet. If you watch it from the front view, it looks like he leads with his helmet. He might not have left his feet, but he launched and used his head as a weapon. Now, you can say, oh, Burfict deserves it, and oh, karma's a real, you know, a real whatever, but that doesn't make what Juju Smith-Schuster did right, okay? If you murder a murderer, you're not just scot-free because the first guy was a murderer. You're now a murderer too. Juju Smith-Schuster, to me, now he may not have the reputation to say that he's a dirty player. He's a rookie, so he's not a dirty player yet, but he's got one strike against him in my book. He is not just absolved of blame because his target is a guy that we think is a dirty player. I don't believe in that. Payback, you know, maybe you think that he deserved it. Maybe you think that Burfict deserves all kinds of bad things because of all the bad things that he does. But it still doesn't make what Juju Smith-Schuster did okay in my mind. It was a dirty play. There was clearly intent to get to Burfict, and I don't believe in that. Champlain Valley Game Night here on 101.3 ESPN. Along the same lines, Ben Roethlisberger was talking, quarterback of the Steelers. He was talking about the rivalries between AFC North foes. And he talked specifically about the rivalry with the Ravens and the rivalry with the Bengals. And Ben Roethlisberger said, basically, the difference between the Ravens and Bengals is that we have respect for the Ravens. That's essentially how it is. We have mutual respect for each other. He says, exactly, there's always respect revolved in the Ravens game. You're going to get hit really hard, or you're going to hit somebody really hard, but you're going to help them up and say, man, nice job. At the end of the day, you're going to shake hands and give the other guy a hug and say, that was a lot of fun and can't wait to do it again next year. It's a fun rivalry in the sense there's a lot of respect and there's two good football teams. And he said that with the Bengals, you feel like you're just out there to hit each other. And I'll say this. I don't know that I like my rivalries featuring an immense amount of respect. And I don't want them to be dirty, okay? I do not want dirty play. But to me, it's not a rivalry then. To me, then it's just two good teams going after it. To me, a rivalry involves an element of hate. It involves an element of jealousy. It involves an element of disdain. If it's just two good teams going at it, then that's what it is. Then it's two good teams going at it. I like my rivalries with some spice. I like my rivalries with some heated moments. I don't want to see guys helped up after big hits. Again, I don't want to see it dirty, but I don't want to see it played between two Mr. Nice guys at times either. It was great for the NBA last year when Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant were feuding. It's not great for them personally, and I hope that they reconcile for their personal lives. But for the league itself, there was real animosity there. It wasn't made up. It wasn't fake. It was real human emotion that was on that floor, and the two teams fed off of it. from Steven Adams on the Thunder side to Draymond Green on the other, there was real feuding going on there, and that was great for the league. When the Seahawks and 49ers didn't like each other, and it was Jim Harbaugh against Pete Carroll, and they played against each other as coaches in the Pac-10, that was real. Richard Sherman against Michael Crabtree, that was real. It wasn't fake. They weren't helping each other up. They were talking smack. And to me, that's a real rivalry. Yankees-Red Sox, when Pedro's throwing guys and A-Rod and Veritek are punching each other and Don Zimmer's getting thrown out by Pedro and Kareem Garcia's talking junk. Again, it's not that was not entirely clean, but that's a rivalry. A rivalry to me has an element of hate, an element of disdain, an element of, man, you've beaten us for years and now we're coming after you. It's not just, hey man, nice hit. That's fine. That's good sportsmanship. That's two good teams. That's okay too. But if we're talking about rivalries, I like my rivalries with a little spice to them. If you want to get in on it, you can on the Town Fair Tire text line. And let's see, we've got Bill in St. Albans who says, Brady, totally agree. Rivalries are in fact rivalries because teams and players do not like each other. I don't want to see it be Mr. Nice Guy. I hate when they all talk after the game and shake hands at center court and or at the midfield. Billy in St. Albans says, not a fan of that. Then we get one. Let's see here. I want to read this one. Maria in South Burlington says, Brady, don't encourage it. Don't encourage being mean-spirited. Let the teams have a mutual respect for each other. That's part of what makes sports good, too, is good sportsmanship. And you are right. And Peyton Manning and Tom Brady talking glowingly of each other, that is good also. But it never felt like a rivalry to me. Number one, Manning and Brady didn't feel like a rivalry to me because they weren't actually playing each other directly. No matter what either of them did, they were going to be dependent on so many other factors. Manning could throw four touchdowns and for 500 yards and still lose because his defense got lit up. That's not a rivalry with Brady in my mind. They never said anything controversial about the other, to the other, never talked down to the other. So it never felt like a rivalry to me. I never sensed there was any real animosity there. And if there was, it never came out. I like my rivalries to be rivalries. Westbrook, Durant, that's a rivalry. Good for the league. LeBron and Curry? I don't know that I saw that as a rivalry. Maybe this year, Boston and Cleveland can be a rivalry because you've got the Isaiah factor in which the hurt is real. The pain is real. The emotion is real. And the revenge factor and his desire for it is going to be real. Maybe now you can get a Boston and Cleveland rivalry, and that'll be a great rivalry in the NBA for at least this year or as long as LeBron and Isaiah are together in Boston and as long as Danny Ainge is the guy calling the shots, or as long as LeBron and Isaiah are together in Cleveland and Danny Ainge is the guy in Boston. All right, that'll do it for us here on Champlain Valley Game Night. Thanks to everyone who joined us in the huddle. We had Imani Toomer, Buster Olney, Field Yates. You missed any of those interviews, they're all available online. Also, here in Champlain Valley Game Night, Stefania Bell, as she is every Wednesday. Coming up tomorrow in the huddle, it will be Ken Kreitz, Matt Verderan. We'll also have Chris Mannix of Yahoo Sports, The Vertical, and NBC Sports Radio talking about the NBA and just how close Isaiah is to returning. That'll be a lot of fun as well. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN. And over on 960 The Zone, starting in 5 minutes, it's Celtics basketball. They're taking on the Dallas Mavericks. So, everybody, we'll see you tomorrow. For Rich, Arnie, I'm Brady. For all the interns, 101.3 ESPN and 101.3 ESPN.com.